Good evening. Welcome to another River Styx at Duff's. Tonight, one of our featured speakers, Clayton Eshelman, is coming in from California, and he's still on his way in. So Michael Castro, director of Duff's, will be bringing him from the airport as soon as the plane lands. Tonight, we're going to start our program with Richard Watson, who is nicknamed Red, and Red teaches philosophy at Washington University. His passions for both running and cave exploring have been the subjects of his heralded novels, The Runner, Under Plowman's Floor, and The Longest Caves, an adventure odyssey of the Flint Mammoth Cave System in Kentucky. He is also the author of The Philosopher's Diet, which received the American Health Association Book of the Year Award. Tonight, Red is going to read from a novel in progress, Niagara.
In 1859, Jean-Francois Gravelet, known as the Great Blondine, was the first man ever to walk across Niagara Falls on a wire. And then some 40 years later, in 1901, the first person ever to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel and survive was a 45-year-old school teacher, a widow, Anna Edson Taylor. These two characters have fascinated me for a long while, and I have written a novel which is called On the Wire Over the Falls, which is a title that no one can accept. It is anachronistic in that it has two characters, one named Gravelet, one named Taylor, two characters who are modeled on two people who in ordinary life never met one another. I put them together for various reasons. One reason is that I was very interested in the question of why it was that Gravelet, the great Blondine, who went back to Europe and was the toast of all of Europe, died covered with honors, actually covered, because there were enormous medals in the pictures of him, that big, his chest covered with medals, this big, touted and lauded all over Europe. Taylor, on the other hand, died a virtual bag lady, another anachronism, at the falls, selling postcards, trying to sell postcards, showing her standing beside her barrel and things like that. And it interests me very much that these two feats at Niagara Falls received such different receptions. So it's a novel in two voices. The first is On the Wire, the other is Over the Falls. I'll read some selections from each, probably about 20 minutes each. And so first, On the Wire. And there's an epigraph for On the Wire from Carl Wallenda. To be on the wire is life. The rest is waiting. High above the ground, the wire. Here is how you walk the wire. Keep your body straight, but push your head forward from the chin. Keep your knees slightly bent. The pole is held on your chest by a harness and by your two hands. The pole rests on the palms of your hands and against your thumbs. You reach around and loop your fingers over it. Do not squeeze. Hold it lightly but firmly. The pole is 24 feet long and weighs 48 pounds. It makes your back ache. It is your life. The wire is, or was then, 4 7/8-inch hemp ropes wrapped tightly around a fifth to make a solid rope 1 7/8 inches in diameter. It sags as it stretches, from anchor to anchor. Every 30 feet, it is guyed by 2 1-inch ropes, one from either side, angling down and away. This is because the wire is meant to be tight, solid. There is such a thing as slack wire walking. It is done on short ropes by pretty little girls in petticoats, spinning parasols. The long wire is different, a different thing. It is rigid, serious, a man's business. You take up the pole, jut your chin forward, look straight out over the wire, and relax. Tension kills. On the other hand, tension is the essence of the wire. It is like a bowstring, stretched, striving for release. If all the guy lines went at once, you would shoot off like an arrow in the blue. Stretch out 1 foot. Rest it on the wire. Press down. Feel the give? Shift your weight to the wire. Back to the platform, to the wire. There's a rhythm. Your body knows when. Your back leg comes forward on its own, and you're on the wire. Exultation. A shiver runs from the base of your spine, up and out through your arms, already sweetly aware of the ache that will come before you are across. But look, you're walking the wire. Each foot comes forward and is placed in front of the other. Short steps, 30 steps for 30 feet. Another world. Yes, you see them. Those pygmies on the ground down below, and up ahead those jackasses, local dignitaries who claim special privileges and come up on the roof with you to make things harder. You look down. Of course you do. You know what's below. But the wire is straight. You train your eyes ahead, along that line. You do not look to the side, and you do not look at your feet. Your feet have eyes of their own. They see the wire. You move along, a slowly measured step. You adjust to the heartbeat of the wire. For the wire lives. It has a pulse. As you walk, the bounce begins. Every step increases the height of the sine waves undulating through the wire. So pause, wait, press your foot down just before the peak of the wire's rise. Introduce a second vibration to interact with and damp down the first. Then another, and another. The curves intersect so that by the time you reach the other side, there are 100 separate pulses racing through the wire, holding one another down, keeping the wire from turning into a bucking bronco that would throw you off. There's more. The wind. You lean into it and hope it does not suddenly stop or change. You always lean with reservations. You never give yourself over to the wind. You lean just far enough and hold yourself there. You do not lean on the wind, you lean against it. Then, if it stops, you do not tumble over. You have been holding yourself at the proper angle, not using the wind for support. When the wind stops, you merely move your body back. When the wind changes, you adjust to the proper angle and direction. There's more. When walking between buildings, watch for little whirlwinds that spiral out when gusts of wind hit the buildings, split and circle to play with you out there on the wire. And when the wire is attached to 2 tall buildings, there's a sway. The buildings themselves rock back and forth in the wind. The wire swings back and forth with them. Watch it. Feel it. Up and down with the pulse. Back and forth with the sway. It is subtle, but you must be with it, the breathing line along which you walk. Now you have it. That thrilling shiver again. Something happens on the wire. It is not that time does not exist there. But it is another time. It is not earth time. It is out of time. It is forever time. And yet you are crossed, and it was no time. If you like, in the middle of the wire, you can unhook your pole, balance it carefully on the wire, and stand on your head. Sometimes I take a chair. balance it on two legs, sit down, and drink a bottle of wine. This is how you walk the wire. When I was a little boy in a tiny village in France, 6 or 7 years old, I ran away with a small traveling circus. It was as simple as that. Here is what happened when I was 16 or 17. It was a windy day. A wire was stretched across the Seine near the newly built Eiffel Tower. On the wire was Conrad the Great and his assistant. They walked out, Conrad in front with the pole, his assistant with a hand on Conrad's shoulder walking behind. They stopped. Conrad crouched, and his assistant put one foot back of Conrad's knee, stepped with his other foot to Conrad's hip, on up to Conrad's shoulders, and carefully stood up. He stretched his arms out. Conrad adjusted to his weight and gripped the pole. Then Conrad started walking across the river with his assistant standing on his shoulders. I was not there, but was told later. They had gone no more than 10 steps, when suddenly one of the assistant's feet slipped off Conrad's shoulder. The poor wretch lurched away and fell head first into the Seine. It was not even 100 feet above the water, but they say it took the fellow a long time to get down. He never came back up. The crowd had forgotten to watch Conrad. He had fallen to one knee on the wire, where he teetered, but a lifetime of experience was not to be wasted by the foolish fall of an incompetent. He unhooked the pole from his chest harness, balanced it on the wire, turned around, picked the pole up again, and walked back in the direction from which he had come. Conrad swore in Polish, in Hungarian, Turkish, Basque. He lay down his pole, spoke harshly to another assistant in one of those languages, shouldered his way through the crowd, and walked toward the Eiffel Tower, around which several little circus groups were performing. He stopped to watch our balancing act. It was the usual supple, tall pole with a platform on top. The only thing that made ours better than others was that I went up with my papa, and while he stood on the platform, I climbed to stand on his shoulders. We held out our arms and swayed back and forth. No hands. When we came down, Conrad was there. Like a vice, he gripped me by the arm and pulled me aside. About all I could understand was that some Scheißkopf, I knew that was German, had killed himself, and Conrad needed a young man. He dragged me through the crowd. I balked, he swore, reached into his pocket for a wallet, and put a brand new 10-franc note into my hand. I went with him. Then he relaxed, although he scowled at anyone who got in the way. He became jovial and told me exactly what had happened. It was a mistake only an idiot could make, a dolt, a nincompoop. Conrad sighed. It was not easy to get good help these days. The shithead had simply not been good enough. A little puff of wind had unbalanced him. But he, Conrad the Great, had a reputation to maintain. He intended to go right back now and do the trick. You've walked the wire before, haven't you? Well, yes, of course I had. Who had not? But only a very short distance, and only a very few times. We did not have the equipment. It was too specialized for such a small circus as ours. Good, was all Conrad said. It is not that I had no choice. When we got down near the Seine and I saw the crowds on both banks, and the roar began as Conrad climbed to the top of the platform and threw up his arms, I wanted to go. Conrad said, put your hand on my shoulder and follow me. I did what he said. We walked a few steps, and Conrad stopped and crouched down. On my shoulders, he said. I stepped on the calf of his leg to his hip to his shoulders. I stood up and held out my arms. Conrad grunted. He did not have to say anything further. He could feel that our balance was perfect. A powerful brute of a man. He huffed loudly, but it meant nothing. Still, as we neared the other side, I heard him mutter in complaint. "What?" I said, afraid I was not hearing instructions. "It was all right, you understand, but I was slightly out of my element." I said, "I'm getting too old for this sort of thing," he snapped, and then he laughed. I think Conrad was 60 years old then. When we reached the other side, I jumped off onto the platform without being told. I blush. I did not just jump. As we reached the platform, I did a flip off Conrad's shoulders. He did not smile, but I could see that he was pleased. When he had brushed off the dignitaries, he took out his wallet, pressed another 10-franc note into my hand, and said, "Do what they tell you," and walked off, leaving me with his other assistants. I was with him 10 years before he fell. I suppose you want to know about the women. A man like me has no trouble getting women. If anything, there's a problem of deciding which. You soon learn to spot the crazy ones, the hysterics. And after you've broken the hearts of a few young girls, if you have any compassion, you do not have a stomach for more of that. Sweet as they are, dear things. Not the frightened ones. Not the bawds. Not the brazen or the bizarre. Not women on the Bree Brown. Not women punishing their husbands. Not women trying to make their boyfriends jealous. Not celebrity fuckers. Not women seeking publicity. No whores. No. Perhaps it is hard to believe, but I always go for the mousy ones. I do not mean that they look like mice. I mean the demure ones. They're not shy, but they do not push forward. Their hair is put up nicely. They smell good. And they wear modest round hats that cover their heads and come down almost over their eyes. They're well-dressed, good cloth on their bosoms, stylish folds to their ankles, perhaps a parasol. You watch the parasol. Probably it twirls. You catch her eye. She seems startled. You shrug. She looks down and then glances up out of the corner of her eye. You smile, an enormous smile. Why do I say you? Me. I smile. I inflate my chest. My body stands out of the crowd and says, "Me, me, me." She smiles wryly. The dance proceeds. My face takes on a look of exquisite longing. Against hope, my eyes yearn. My arms rise. My hands and shoulders make the slightest of movements. It is a question. Will you, oh, will you please, young madame? For of course she is a married woman. Will you come to me after I walk the wire? I am a man. My life is a life of danger, in defiance of death. I am vulnerable. I am simple. I live from day to day. Your quiet beauty, your charms, have devastated me. I am full of desire. I want you. I relax and spread my arms wide. Through the crowd, she looks at me. She smiles broadly now. She drops her chin. The sign is barely perceptible. She has said, "Yes." I know. She sees that I know. I'm ecstatic. Quietly, of course. She turns her back and makes as though to stroll off. But she looks over her shoulder. Yes, she will be there. You want to know more? So, my friend,
do I. Is it really like that? I really do not know. Most of them put on a good front. Of course, sometimes they cry. Why your tears, little one? Never mind, they say, dabbing at their eyes with a hanky. It's because I'm silly. It's because you make me happy. Sometimes I believe what they say. Over the years, Conrad continued to carry me. One day, we walked out on the wire. Conrad crouched. I stepped on the inside of his knee, then to his hip, onto his shoulders. Conrad crouched down further. This was not right. He was supposed to straighten up as I stood on his shoulders. I could feel his effort. He stood up. "My knee," he said quietly. Then his right leg collapsed. I did what had to be done. I caught the wire. I had plenty of time. You always have plenty of time when your heartbeat leaps to 200 a minute, when every split-second movement is very serious. I saw clearly, as though time had slowed, what went wrong with Conrad. His injured knee made his right leg useless. As he crumbled to the right, he should have let his pole go to the right. But for some reason, I suppose his instinct was that he should try to recover his balance. He tried to tip the pole to the left, just for an instant. Then he let it go right. I had slid down to the middle of his back as he dropped. He should have bellied on the wire. None of this fancy stuff of falling by and catching it with his hands. No tricks. I was trying to get off his back. I wanted to land on my feet on the wire, but I saw I could not, so I bellied. Conrad hit the wire with his chest, reached over with his arms, and then I hit the wire. His body rose, floated over the wire, and slid back. He still had his arms out and would catch. Then the wire bounced back up, tapped Conrad lightly on the chin. He jerked back. His fingertips brushed the wire, and he drifted away. Slowly, oh so slowly, back and down and away, his arms outstretched, his eyes focused on the wire. "Wait," I wanted to shout, but I was mute. "Come back. There is time. We can do it again. This time you let the pole go to the right immediately. You do not lose that split second when you tried to recover your balance. Then when I come down and the wire comes up, it just grazes your chin. It smacks into your two hands and you hold. You hold as you could have held a line thrown out by a speeding locomotive. You hold as you could even if your arms were torn from their shoulder sockets. You had a grip that no man in Europe could endure. You won bets and bistros with that grip. Conrad, wait! Hold on! But perhaps not. Maybe an elbow would have gone too. He was too old. His knee collapsing did not kill him. His recovery was not perfect. He made a mistake. The consequences were serious. He always said they would be. On the wire, what one does, it is always serious. Gravelet the Great? It could not be denied. It was coming through. I wonder if the volume was not building up, even as Conrad fell. The thunder, now. Gravelet, the great Gravelet. I did not look for someone else. Several applied, but I had lost my stomach for working with others. And on my very first walk as sole performer, I started exhibiting what I would build into an enormous repertoire. I stood on my head. I did flips. I pretended to fall. I ran backwards and made tremendous leaps. And now
What could I not do on the wire? That too, jackass. Just find me a woman who will comply. Well, Gravelet found out that the great Gravelet wasn't really enough. The great Conrad was too great. He had to do something. And so he came across in an encyclopedia a picture of Niagara Falls and decided that was the thing to do, so he went to Niagara Falls and went over it. And he arranged to do lots of things. One of the things he was going to do was to take his manager across in a wheelbarrow. The day came for the wheelbarrow ride over Niagara Falls. I could tell the signs. My manager had no intention of joining me on the wire. I had no idea what he thought we were going to do, for it had been advertised far and wide, and there were large crowds on both banks. The time approached, and he disappeared as I had predicted. Then he reappeared with Taylor. She was grotesque. You remember those pretty little girls in petticoats walking the slack wire? So petite and pert in their tights. Taylor was the antithesis of these. It was not entirely apparent at first, because she was holding a full-length cloak clutched around her neck. I saw at once what my manager had arranged. He need not have been so devious. I did not need to be tricked. I would have wheeled a cow across the gorge if she could be depended upon to relax and sit still. Now, apparently, I should have my chance. For my manager led Taylor up onto the platform, took hold of her cloak at the shoulders and whipped it off, revealing a very large woman. I positioned the wheelbarrow on the wire over the platform, stepped up and adjusted myself to the balance. A wheelbarrow is not like a pole, but if you concentrate always on keeping the wheel on the knife edge, equal weights resting on either side of the wire, you are as solid as a stone. The faster you go, the easier it is to adjust for balance. I nodded to Taylor to step up onto a stool and get in. I refused to let anyone steady the wheelbarrow. I wanted to wrestle it myself. Under my instructions, she put a foot carefully in the middle, like entering a canoe, reached across with one hand to the other side, shifted her weight, and sat down with her knees up, facing me, a serious look on her face, but yet a smile, in my wheelbarrow. That she could follow instructions so well, despite surely being under great stress, encouraged me. So far, so good. I tipped the wheelbarrow to the left and right, and she instinctively moved to the right and left to keep her balance. She did not lunge. She did not seem overly worried. So far, very good. If the lady will relax, all will go well, I said. What would you have said in reply? Your first time on the wire, nearly 200 feet above Whirlpool Rapids, to ride in a wheelbarrow 1,300 feet across the Niagara River Gorge over the falls. Do not tell me. I already know. Your face would have turned white. Your throat would have been too dry for speech. You would have nodded, and far from relaxing as instructed, you would have been as tense as the wire itself on which our wheelbarrow sat. I would have had to fight your stiff weight all the way across. Not Taylor. Why, I feel just fine, Mr. Gravelet, she said, her smile broadening. She was relaxed. This large woman, in white linen, covered with red and blue ruffles and bows. I feel just fine, she said, and she talked to me all the way across. Well, a lot goes on between Gravelet and Taylor, but I'm turning now to the second voice, second part, Over the Falls. And the epigraph for this part is from Christina Georgina Rossetti. Remember me when I am gone away.
I had a petition when I was 10 years old. June 21st, 1866, Hardy, Nebraska. Please do not fire Mr. Hurd. It was signed by all 12 pupils in our one-room school. Georgie Smith can't write, my mother said, glancing at the petition but not taking it. I presented it to her because she was the main one who got Mr. Hurd fired. It was too late, I knew that. He'd already left town by the time we kids heard about it. I signed Georgie's name for him, I said. The story of my life. I was a big, ugly girl. She became a school teacher. Superior was a bigger town than Hardy, where I'd grown up. There were over 200 people in Superior, and I'd been teaching there already 4 years. Matthew came to the box social at the start of the school year. All the girls and women brought a supper for two people in a box, fancied up with ribbons and bows, and they were sold to the highest bidders among the men and boys. It was supposed to be a secret. They always knew whose box was being bid on, and they tried to get the one they wanted to sit and eat with. The young folk set a lot of store on it, and sometimes there were fights. The money went for school supplies, and we sure needed it. I knew all about Matthew Taylor. He'd been in Superior for a whole month, after all. We'd already met eating dinner at folks' houses, because you'd better believe there were matchmakers in Superior, and they just about despaired of getting me married off. He may have wondered at the time how I looked at him, because I knew already he was mine. So when he came into the school, where all the desks and benches had been pushed back against the wall, I steered him to the middle of the room, to the table, with all the box suppers on it. I put my hand on mine and whispered, "Matthew, buy this one." "What?" he said. "This one," I said, nodding at him with a big smile. "Yes, all right," he said, sort of worried. Then I let him go over and talk with the men. He bought it, but it cost him a pretty penny. Two of the first grade boys had saved their pennies all summer to bid on my box. So when it was held up, before anyone else could say a word, Jimmy Anderson said loud and clear, "I bid a penny." Everyone laughed, because most bids started out at a nickel. Jimmy turned red, but he stood his ground. And before the laughing was over, Benny Dondlinger said, "I bid 2 pennies. The boys glared at each other. A hush came over the room, and some of the little girls started to titter, but some of the men frowned severely, which was pretty difficult for them to do when they were so mused. Jimmy and Benny didn't see anybody but each other in that box. It was a nice box. I'd fix it up real pretty with dry thistle heads on it for decoration, which some of the women complimented me on. "Shush, shush," several people said. "3, Jimmy said. Then Art Palmer, who always was the auctioneer at local sales and was presiding now, spoke up firmly and said, "I'm a bid of 3 of 3 for this nice box." He held it up. "Do I hear a 4? "Need a 4. 4, Benny said. "And a 5, Art said, for the box. Come on, 5. Have a 4. Need a 5. Who's got a nickel for the very fine box?" 5, Jimmy said, and jingled his pennies loudly in his pocket. "Oppa," one of the men yelled and picked Jimmy up and set him out in the middle of the room. Another man stood Benny facing Jimmy, and they stepped back. 6, Benny said. Art carried on with his auctioneer's talk, longer and longer each time, running it out. "A dime, I hear, a big, big silver dime." As the bidding moved on and reached 20 cents, I looked sadly over at Matthew. He had been set to start the bidding at a nickel, as he'd seen others do, but he hadn't had a chance. He stood there with his mouth open and gave me a frantic look. I shrugged at him with a smile. 2 dimes, 20 cents, would you believe it? Not that it ain't worth every penny of it, this very fine box, but who'd have ever thought that this little tyke would have saved up so much money? By God, if this ain't a rake bid and a great auction. Several of the men whooped again. 21, Jimmy said, when everyone quieted down. Benny looked worried, and Art's voice became softer. Everybody knew the end was in sight. 22, 23, 24, Benny said with terror in his eyes. And before Art could get in with another line of patter, Jimmy shrieked, 25! And Benny burst out in tears. People cheered, and some of them tried to calm Benny down, who was sobbing. When the hollering quieted down, I glanced over at Matthew and could see he didn't know what to do. This was the first box social he'd ever been to, and before I could stop him, he cleared his throat. Everybody turned toward him, and he blushed just like Jimmy had, who'd started the bidding. 26, he said. And now Jimmy burst out bawling. It was pandemonium. Shame, somebody shouted. And there was booing. Then above the uproar, Art Palmer shouted, time out! Everybody quieted down again. Benny and Jimmy were taken aside by several men who crouched down, got out their handkerchiefs to dry the boys' tears, and glancing back over their shoulders at Matthew, talked to them. Pretty soon, the men stepped back, and the two boys stood together, smiles on their tear-stained faces. Come on, Art, let's get on with the auction, one of the men said. Dito, Art said, I got a 26. Is there another bid? 27, Jimmy said. Matthew looked around, mortified that he'd done something wrong, until one of the men said gruffly, well, you're going to bid or ain't you? 28, Matthew said. Thank goodness he had enough sense not to bid more than a penny at a time. People cheered up again, and there was clapping and laughter as the bidding increased until finally Jimmy said, 49, which everybody knew was all the money the two boys had in combination. I got 49, Art raised his voice and carried on for several minutes at a fast rate until everybody was stomping and yelling. Finally, Art shouted, do I hear 50? The noise stopped, and everyone looked at Matthew. Matthew had his handkerchief out, and he mopped the sweat off his brow. He looked around, cleared his throat. 50, he said, his voice cracking. We got married that winter. I was 20, and Matthew was 24. Right after the wedding, he took sick to bed, which didn't bother me at the time because I knew he had a weakly constitution and I'd have to look after him. Later, I realized that this had been the first serious onset of the disease that 7 years later killed him. She stays on teaching, raises the two kids. They go off to California, and she stays on teaching. One day, I was reading a newspaper, and I saw this advertisement. Wanted, brave man to ride the rapids in a barrel through the Niagara Falls Gorge. Make a name for yourself in the history books. Contact Harry Calcourt, Niagara Falls, New York. I tore the advertisement out and pinned it on the kitchen wall. And after looking at it every day for a week, I sat down to write a letter. Dear sir, I am a woman, but I am strong, and I what? I could say I needed a job, but I didn't. That I was brave? Well, sure, I even rode steers in the town rodeo until I got so old I was embarrassed by it. Matthew encouraged it until he died. He took particular delight in my winning prizes. I could say that probably riding the rapids was something like riding steers, and I could do it. What attracted me most about the advertisement, I tried not to think of at first, but later I clung to it. I saw that Mr. Calcourt was right. If I were to do that thing, ride that barrel, my name would go down in history books. I knew about Sam Patch, and his name was at least in a geography book in the section on Niagara Falls. Sam Patch dived from the top of the falls into the basin below. There wasn't much more than that said about him, and I didn't learn till later that he'd been killed trying it again. But that had been 50 years ago, and nobody had done anything like it since. There was his name in the book, Sam Patch. I had a good name, too. But nobody knew it. Anna Edson Taylor. Why not put my name in a book? Yes, by God. My life was empty, and I wasn't going to do anything else.
Why not ride in that man's barrel? Dear sir, I am a woman, but I am strong. I've ridden steers in a rodeo. I am able and willing to ride a barrel through the rapids. Yours very truly, Anna Edson Taylor. There wasn't any reply to my letter. And in truth, I guess I hadn't really expected one. I more or less forgot about it. Except the advertisement was still pinned on the kitchen wall when one day, about 6 months later, the station master from the train depot came to my house to give me a telegram. He looked at me full of questions, for of course he knew what it said. July 1st, 1901. Anna Edson Taylor, Superior, Nebraska. Job open. Come immediately. Harry Calcourt, Niagara Falls, New York. How did I do it? Leave my home. Or maybe you might ask, how could I do it? I've thought a lot about that. And as Mr. Gravelet used to say, pourquoi pas, which is French and means in English, why not? I was 45 years old. I was in the prime of my life and brains and fitness, as far as I could tell, and I would probably live to be 100 if I stayed there in Superior, Nebraska. I could have gone on teaching school until kingdom come. But the stream of my life was so shallow and sluggish that there was hardly any flow. It wasn't worth a hill of beans, it seemed to me, to be moving so slowly and going nowhere. Sure, teaching is an honorable service to mankind. Then what? Not out of discontent, so much as from not caring, did I sell and pack up and go to Niagara Falls. It just didn't matter. It might make my life better or worse, but whichever, it would be a change, and the difference would make me feel I was alive. That would be true even if I found myself going somewhere I didn't want to go, as in truth happened often enough later on, because there is some excitement just in moving along. It was the weather. I've thought about it. I really have. Why I left my home and place of security. The weather in Nebraska is pretty mean. Hot and dry in the summer, cold and hard in the winter, the wind blowing year-round. You might think Niagara Falls is no improvement, all that snow, which in fact I didn't even know about at the time I left. It was the monotony in Nebraska that finally flattened out so thin, and everything so much the same that there was nothing to hold me there, like I was a tumbleweed, and not a rock or stick anywhere to catch and keep me from rolling right over the edge of the horizon. Nebraska is not kind. In the summer, the sun blazes down, white hot. The dust is always in your eyes and throat, and sometimes you can hardly breathe. And the wind! Then the winter comes with snow and cold like Siberia, and the wind never lets up. Wheat grows in the summer, if you're lucky, and range cattle survive the winter, if you're lucky. It's not an easy life. But you know, I remember one evening. It was sometime in early September, getting on to fall, which in Nebraska is usually that one day it's hot summer and the next day it's cold winter. But anyway, this one day in September, the world was wonderful. We all noticed it. Matthew came home from his office early and we took a walk. I carried Teddy, who was just a baby, and held Jane, who was 3, by one hand. Matthew held Jane's other hand, and we walked down to the creek and watched the sunset through the cottonwoods. The air was so sweet. There wasn't any wind. Oh, I don't know. Everything seemed to be all right. It was as though God were kind. That was one day in my life in Nebraska. When I stood looking at Matthew's grave for the last time, the sun was blistering, the sky was yellow, and a fine dust on the wind hurt my eyes and powdered my clothes. There were dust devils rising in the surrounding fields. Goodbye, Matthew, I said, and turned and left.
Belay has, and she rides in his wheelbarrow all summer. And then toward the end of the summer, Harry Calcourt comes to her, and she says, "You mean you still want me to ride a barrel in the rapids?" I said. I'd forgotten all about it. But now I was going to ride the rapids in a barrel after all. So the summer had been just an interlude. All the time the river waiting to take me. And strange to say, it was harder for me now than it would have been before, because riding the rapids in a barrel wasn't going to be so very nice as in Mr. Gravelet's wheelbarrow. Mr. Calcourt took me to a cooper so I could see how I fit in the barrel. It looked solid enough. Of course, it was uncomfortable when I got inside, but what could you expect? The cooper pounded on the outside of the barrel with the flat of his hand and said, "Don't you worry, you'll be safe as a bug as a rug going over the falls in this barrel." I let them help me out of the barrel, and I stood looking at it a moment, and then I turned to Mr. Calcourt, and I said, "Over the falls?" "Why, yes, Mrs. Taylor," he said, trying to make nothing of it. "People's already gone down the rapids." It went awfully fast. The barrel was caught in the current and flipped upright. It was almost silent now the boat was gone, and though I couldn't see, I felt that I was flying down the river. Then I hit the rapids above the falls. I hung on the straps and tried not to bump my head. It took me nearly 20 minutes to reach the falls, they said, but it seemed no time at all to me. I could hear the roar coming up fast, and I knew when it happened. I was facing front, and the barrel tipped forward. There was a kind of silence in the roar, and then I was thrust up against the top of the barrel. I can't describe how suddenly there was a force that took the barrel down and down and down like a locomotive going straight down into the bowels of hell. I don't know that I thought that then. It was what I made up for my talk. But something like that anyway. It was the moment I had been waiting for, and it would be over very soon. And then the outcome of all those months of waiting would be known. She made it. She went on the stage, and people vilified her. They shouted nasty things from the audience, and literally it was impossible for her to give talks. Well, they could say bad things, but they couldn't take away from me what I'd done. It's there in the history books to prove. For I was the first and only one, there couldn't be another, the one to go first over Niagara Falls in a barrel and live. But those men were jealous, and though they couldn't take away what I'd done, they did call me a crazy whore, and my triumph just a stunt, as though it lacked legitimacy, like I'd been born a bastard. And they said a man put me up to it anyway. Let me tell you, it may take a man to get a woman pregnant, but she has to go on and have the baby all by herself. Mr. Calcourt even suggested I change my name. "Then you could get a job teaching school again," he said. "Change my name? Ha! That's a laugh. Not bloody likely, as Mr. Gravelet used to say. Don't you forget my name. Anna Edson Taylor. Edson's my maiden name. Sometimes they spell it with an I, Edison, like the inventor, but that's not right. I'm my own person, and it's Edson. Anna Edson Taylor. Remember me, what I did on October 4th, 1901. Anna Edson Taylor, a widowed school teacher, admitted age 41, but I was really 45. The first person ever to go over Niagara Falls on purpose, in a barrel, and to survive. To live, having done as a woman a dangerous and wondrous thing, as good as any man. I always said forget-me-not was of my favorite flower, and I ask you don't forget me now. Anna Edson Taylor, and what I've done. That's about all. You don't care how I get along now. Not too well, thank you, anymore. But that's the way it goes when you get old. I don't worry about it. I get along. True, it's not the way I thought it would be. I got my name in the history books, all right. But I'd expected to make some money lecturing to put aside for my old age. And I'd expected people to respect what I did. I sure didn't think they'd turn on me and call me crazy and a whore. But that was mostly men who did it. And I don't suppose they could help themselves, seeing as they're weaker than a woman when it comes to holding on and enduring. They lack patience. Even Mr. Gravelet didn't have much of that. Anyway, I showed what a woman could do as good as any man, and I was the first, and my name is in the history books. Anna Edson Taylor. I have this dream, and it's not a nightmare, though it might sound like one, in which I'm floating down a river. I'm not in a barrel or anything. I'm just there, sort of above the water and going along. Then I come to this big falls and go over. It's not frightening at all. It's a good feeling. I just float out over the edge, and I'm free and happy falling, gently falling. Thank you.